Behind the Curtain with Jack Berkman.
Welcome to another edition of Behind the Curtain with Jack Berkman. Remember, this is the only talk show in America, radio, television, internet, anywhere, hosted by a registered lobbyist. That's right, we actually said the words registered lobbyist. Can you believe it? Here you hear from the real power brokers, the people who really move Washington, D.C. and move this nation. What a week you're going to hear all about, with Betsy DeVos being confirmed earlier in the week. You'll hear all about my plans to do away with the Department of Education, not cut it by 5%, 10%, get rid of the darn thing. We'll be talking also about these bad hombres in Mexico, as Donald Trump calls them. Wait till you see the drugs that they are selling to your children. It's not just immigration coming from there. It's drugs, drugs, and more drugs. That's why Donald Trump wants to use federal troops. Mexico increasingly is not being nice to its northern neighbor, let me tell you. Finally, our friend Horace Cooper will be here, probably America's brightest constitutional mind, to talk about just why the Ninth Circuit is so messed up with this travel ban. Wait till you see. But first up, just a minute, we'll have our friend Rich Noyes, longtime contributor to this program, research director of the Media Research Center. What a great institution that is. He's going to be telling us all about, well, one, how the media is labeling, stereotyping, and mistreating Donald Trump. But more specifically, we're going to break down the media's use of this conservative label. You'll notice they call all of Donald Trump's nominees, oh, he's an extreme conservative, he's very conservative, he's a far-out conservative, stuff like that. But they don't call Hillary's potential picks an extreme liberal. They didn't call Merrick Garland, Obama's nominee. They don't say, oh, Merrick Garland is an extreme liberal. Of course he is, but nobody says that. They don't say that because they want to change the way you think. Well, remember, if you want to take it behind the curtain, call us 703-795-5364, 703-795-5364. Also, if you know anything about the Seth Rich murder mystery, same number, 703-795-5364. We need any information out there, and not just those of you in the D.C. metropolitan area. Remember, operators standing by 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Saturday. Note those times, all times Eastern Standard Time for those of you on the West Coast. Rich Noyes, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jack.
Well, Trump is really at war with the media in a way and at a level that even people like George Bush couldn't have dreamt of, right?
Well, he definitely is. He was in the campaign, but I think it's actually been ramped up since he became president of the United States. You know, they thought his pivot was going to be to become more presidential, more sedate. In fact, I think he's become a little more rambunctious since entering
the Oval
Office.
It's a good word. That's a new word. We're going to enter that word into Webster's, rambunctious. But go ahead.
Yeah, and I think he's really gotten inside the media's head on this. You know, he's criticized them for being dishonest. He's called them out. And now what are the news programs? Instead of trying to report the news, they're just trying to, go after Donald Trump and sort of criticize him back. It's become this game of tit for tat. You know, he tweets, walks away, does his job for the rest of the day, and they sit there and they can't get beyond it. And I think it's making the media look petty in all of this, making them look partisan. And I think at the end of the day, that's Trump's strategy, and the media are playing right into it by being so thin-skinned.
All right, let's talk about the one thing I like about you guys is it's just not the usual ideological blathering. You guys have a lot of facts to back it up. So we're now saying you've done a study that shows five times the media, specifically ABC, NBC, CBS, the big three broadcast networks, are five times as likely to describe Republican Supreme Court nominees as extreme than they are Democratic nominees. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, this is going back to John Roberts. We looked at three Republicans, John Roberts, Sam Alito, and now Neil Gorsuch. Looked at three Democratic appointees, all from President Obama, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Merrick Garland, who did not make it to the court. Looking at coverage over these last 12 years, and the first day when these nominees were brought out, the Republican nominees had many conservative labels. Ideology was a big factor in how the media introduced them to the country. The Democratic nominees, almost none. Sotomayor was two liberal labels. Kagan was one. CBS worried she'd move the court to the right. Merrick Garland.
CBS was worried that CBS said Kagan would move the court to the right?
That was the question.
Oh, my God. I need a drink. I have to pour some alcohol. Go ahead. Continue, please.
Merrick Garland, there were four liberal labels. but 9 moderate labels, basically saying he's not liberal. We don't know what Garland would have turned out to be as a Supreme Court nominee, but look at Sotomayor and Kagan.
Oh, yes, we do, Rich. Go ahead. Continue.
Sotomayor and Kagan have been justices now for several years. They vote solidly with the liberal bloc. There was no reason not to call them liberals at the time. You know, if anybody has deviated from the way they were introduced, it's John Roberts, who has actually gone to the left several times. He's not the very, very conservative
sheep in wolf's
nominee.
Clothing. Sheep in wolf's clothing. Don't get me started with Roberts. I'm going to throw up. I don't want to vomit in the studio. Don't get me started with Roberts. Is the all-time betrayal in American history. But that's another. Don't get me started with him. Okay. So this is really, you know, if you look at what really galls me is the media in a more immediate context. Like you're doing a good job taking it all the way back to 05. But if you look at people like Merrick Garland. I mean, the media, so our viewers have in very recent times, our viewers and listeners remember Merrick Garland. A lot of people might not remember the confirmation of John Roberts, but a guy like Merrick Garland, the media treated him with such esteem last year. I mean, they built him up to be the greatest scholar in world history. I mean, never did they refer to him as anything outside the mainstream. Never did they use any kind of, he was never described with any extreme words, was he?
No. And he, you know, Chuck Todd at NBC said he was the almost perfect pick from President Obama. You know, Republicans could not deny him a hearing without really hurting themselves. You know, they thought the tide was turning against them. You know, there's been this whole industry built up. You know, I would think there's at least 14 or 15 Republican senators did meet with him, gave him the hearing he wanted in private. And, you know, but now, in coverage of Gorsuch, people like Chris Matthews are on TV saying not a single Republican ever met with Merrick Garland. They're trying to rewrite history.
Well, I saw that in person. I was there. Republicans met with Merrick Garland. That's a joke. Republicans
talked
to him.
But the media are rewriting the story to make the Democrats' extreme attitude towards Gorsuch seem as if it's justified somehow. Talking about these candidates based on their ideology makes the Democratic lie that their extremists seem justified. Making these false claims about never meeting with it or giving poor treatment to Garland makes the treatment of Gorsuch seem justified. It is myth-making by the media, not factual reporting.
I'll tell you, so let me ask you this. Let's talk a little bit about strategy. So we know all this. I mean, you're doing a wonderful job with statistics in a way that nobody else in the country does. But at the same time, we kind of know all this. You're just putting the facts behind it and showing us how bad it really is. If you're Donald Trump, what do you do with media strategy? I mean, you're the expert. I mean, just looking at this, I mean, if you look at Kellyanne Conway, I think is effective. She's generally effective. They're kind of using two press secretaries instead of one. Spicer, I mean, watching Spicer this week, I mean, nobody would ever accuse Sean Spicer of being a star. I mean, something's, I don't know, why do they pick people like that? Is that really a good choice?
Well, it depends on the job. I mean, I think you need a combination of, you know, let's call them good cops and bad cops to go out there. You know, you need people who almost cultivate the media, you know, give them the planted leak now and then to make them feel like they're welcome, make them feel important. And then you got somebody else who goes out there and reads them the riot act when they do something wrong. And, you know, it sort of helps keep the doors open at one time while making sure you don't take any nonsense with somebody else. I think, you know, the White House is still sort of figuring its way out. But, you know, what Trump has done that has so maddened the media has gone around them in so many ways. You know, that's something where, you know, there's been this extreme barrage of negative publicity since he was sworn into office. You know, this is not a honeymoon. This is more like a Valentine's Day massacre in the first 3 weeks. And yet his approval ratings seem not to have gone down at all. I mean, we may be reaching a point where he's impervious to the liberal media telling their liberal audiences that he's no good, because these people have already made up their minds and they're not convincing anybody who's on Trump's team to get off.
Rich Noyes, Media Research Center, MRC. Rich, if we're real lucky, we'll be able to have you back again. Thank you so much. When we come back, we'll be talking about the bad hombres south of the border that are trying to sell drugs to your children.
All the stories and controversies that no one talks about, but everyone should know about.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
Behind the Curtain with Jack Berkman.
Later in the show, we're going to talk all about my plans to get rid of the Department of Education. Don't miss that. I don't want to cut it by 10% or 30% or 50%. I want to cut it by 102% and rent the buildings out to somebody else. That's what I want to do. Rent the buildings out and start bringing in revenue for you, the taxpayer. Remember, if you want to take it behind the curtain, you call us 703-795-5364. 703-795-5364. Also, if you know anything about the Seth Rich murder mystery, remember, I represent the family. 703-795-5364. Call us, please. In just a minute, we'll be joined by Kent Runyon, Chief Strategy and Compliance Officer at Novus Medical Detox Center. Kent is an all-around expert in many of the aspects of drugs and the terrible drug trade. He's going to enlighten us and educate us. Mexico, we focus on the immigration issues, and rightly so, because that's where a lot of it comes across the border from. But believe it or not, there are even bigger problems than immigration. And those problems are a growing drug trade. Mexico is also where the United States gets most of its drugs, and not just little league drugs, but high-level drugs like heroin, cocaine, and many others. And now all of these terrible opioid pills like Percocet and Vicodin and all the like, and all of this stuff is now flowing from Mexico. The techniques that these drug dealers use are getting more and more sophisticated. It's not just the guy that stands on the corner or stands near the schoolyard with his bag of cocaine. They're getting far more insidious and far more dangerous and far more deadly. Now they're people that have all of these marketing and internet techniques, and they're more deadly and more dangerous than ever. Kent, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Well, enlighten us on, give me some context on the scope of this problem, and then let's talk specifics.
Well, you know, we're seeing upwards of 80 or so Americans dying of opioid overdose every day.
Every day. Every day. So that's, what are we talking? We're talking about 2,500 people a month die from narcotics.
Correct.
Wow.
And, you know, related to the heroin epidemic is what's happening with prescription opioids. We know that right now in America, we consume 80% of the global supply of opioids consumed. So overwhelmingly, our country is...
Sad, but it doesn't surprise me, because we probably also consume 80% of the world's supply of butter or steak or what have you. So it just fits. It's just another statistic that fits in, right?
True. But unfortunately, this connects us to, you know, not everyone can afford to keep up at that pace. Because and we're doing better as a country trying to shut down these pill mills and some of the access to narcotics through prescription mechanisms, which leaves sometimes those individuals going the direction of heroin, which is less expensive and equally available, unfortunately.
So heroin as a drug is less expensive than if somebody takes Vicodin, Percocet, or some kind of pill. Is that how it works?
For sure. I was talking to a client not that long ago. He was a successful business person and got addicted to prescription opioids after a surgery. It was prescribed to him. He was taking it appropriately, got addicted to it, and his doctor stopped prescribing it to it. Him to it. He started getting fearful of, you know, trying to get it through illegal means, doctor shopping and other mechanisms, and his trainer at his gym turned him on to a heroin dealer.
Oh, my God.
And this middle-class business person became addicted to heroin.
Oh, my God. How terrible. How terrible. Well, okay, so now let's talk about what's coming over from Mexico. So Donald Trump, let's put this in a political strategic context. Donald Trump now is talking about using troops to stop immigration and to stop drugs. Tell me what you think of that. What's coming over the border? How are they doing it, and how do we stop it?
Well, it's complicated because, you know, this is, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, it's a highly sophisticated network of highly, with a lot of money. So they've, you name it, they've got planes, trains, and automobiles, along with boats and paid-off officials and paid-off, you know, people that are supposed to be protecting our interests. So
it's complicated because they've got a lot of people who are willing to take serious risks to get the heroin into our
country. How does it come over? Describe how they are getting it over, and what are they? How is most of it coming?
I don't know. I can tell you exactly how majority. I mean, we're confiscating it. You know, literally, they have some. I mean, there's submarines that they use.
Military submarines.
They've got these miniature there have been some that have been caught. But you know, they can afford high tech equipment.
And so the subs come to, what do? They leave the west coast of Mexico and they land somewhere in Orange County on the beach or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same way that we're seeing, people come across the border to immigrate. You know, I mean, it's, if you can get a human being in, you can get a package of heroin in. And I think a lot of times they're paying illegal immigrants to carry it. I mean, you name it, they're doing it. And like, along with, like I said, across right through, cars, or they build it into cars. They don't care if these people get caught. But if you throw 20 cars across and five of them get through, they're still making big money.
So let me ask you this.
They're willing to lose some.
Doesn't the U.S. government, I mean, we have all this fancy intel and satellites and this, that, and the other that we can use to pin down Osama bin Laden. Why can't we use that intel to find out where there are big storage dumps and where these people are concentrated and then just go in and whack them the way we whack ISIS? Maybe that's what we should do.
Hey, it's a complicated problem with there's a lot of holes in the system. We need to use every resource and every form of technology available to give our law enforcement teams those opportunities.
I always wonder, if you're the president of the United States, obviously, if you're Obama or Trump or Clinton or anybody, you talk about this problem to the president of Mexico. What does the president of Mexico say in either party down there? What do they say when you say, well, all these drugs are coming from your country? What do they say? Well, Mr. President, I'm just helpless. There's nothing we can do. We can't control the borders. We're just helpless. Is that the answer? Or what are they? I wonder what these conversations are like.
Yeah, I'm sure they don't have access to those conversations. But yeah, it's certainly
It's crazy
for us.
It's crazy that this goes on. I mean, the United States has used troops to control various problems in Mexico in the past. We did it 100 years ago, right, with our friend Pancho Villa. We did it then. I wonder if we just shouldn't be doing it again now. I mean, it just seems so helpless. We're always so helpless. I mean, you can't use force at the border. It just seems like any use of force, the media won't permit. These people have a right to invade the country, and now you're saying something I didn't even know. A lot of the illegal aliens are carrying dope over the border.
Well, and I don't know that's true, but I can tell you, and frequently I think those people are likely victims. I mean, a lot of people who are in these cartels don't have a lot of choice. It's either you do it or you die.
Yeah, you know,
these are very
violent. I'll be honest with you. I don't really care about them or that circumstance or if they live or die. The only thing the United States should be caring about is stopping drugs. I don't really care if these people are living in peril down there. If I were president, what I would do is I think we have to start using force. We have to use satellites. We have to find out where these people are, and we have to go in and hit them with some bunker buster bombs the way you hit ISIS. I think that's what you do, but we're afraid to do that because we don't want to make any waves. Nobody wants to make any waves. Kent Runyon, thank you so much. Chief Strategy and Compliance Officer, Novus Medical Detox Center. If we're lucky, we'll be able to have you back again. Coming up next, we're going to get into Betsy DeVos and the Department of Education. Stay tuned.
Where everything is depicted as a Washington Post political cartoon.
Behind the Curtain with Jack Berkman.
Welcome back. Later in the show, we have our friend Horace Cooper, the great legal scholar, constitutional scholar. He'll tell us all about what the Ninth Circuit is doing and how messed up the travel ban stuff is. Wait till you hear how the Ninth Circuit is scamming you and scamming President Trump. Oh, my God, is that bad? In just a moment, we have an equally great expert, Jeannie Allen, CEO, Center for Education Reform, one of the foremost experts in education in the country. Well, I think that now that Betsy DeVos is confirmed, she should do what Rick Perry should do at that other DOE, the Department of Energy. Department of Energy and Department of Education are the two waste products of the federal government. They're actually worse than HUD, Housing and Urban Development. Could you imagine things worse than HUD? Well, there are. There are. It's education and energy. Now, we'll leave energy for another day. I think what needs to be done with the U.S. Department of Education is very simple. You go to Congress, you kill its appropriation, you never sign another bill containing any appropriation for it, you shut it down, you fire all the workers, and you rent the building, and instead of spending billions, you bring revenue to the taxpayer from renting all of its buildings. Jeannie Allen, welcome.
Thank you, Jack.
Do you agree?
Well, you know, I hate to start off not agreeing, but I guess mine is really more of a practical issue than it is a philosophical issue. You're absolutely right. There's nothing in the Constitution that talks about a federal role in education, but we had the same programs before the department was created. So the department really was, as you all know, the gift to the unions from Jimmy Carter way back when. Just some idle history. And so the department has.
I didn't know that, by the way. I did not know that, by the way.
Oh, okay, interesting.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, but the program. But I always argue in jest with my conservative colleagues because it's almost irrelevant whether there's a department or not, because there are programs, and the programs have been in place since 1965. Many of them. And some of the programs are well-intentioned programs to make up gaps, not just in funding, but to make up gaps where we have historically underserved kids. And
no one, liberal or
conservative, can disagree with making up those gaps.
The
problem which you're identifying is that federal control that comes with only 10% of funds makes up something like 50% of rules and regulations. And so the debate has typically been, and there was just a bill introduced this week to abolish the Department of Education, it becomes a sideline issue, and it's kind of a distraction for conservatives, I believe, in the sense that really we should just be talking about empowering people with school choice and doing that at the state level. And if we do that at the state level, which is a much bigger problem than abolishing the department, right? It's a much bigger issue. If we give more people choice, if we give parents the power to take their money allocated for their schools and follow that to the school of their choice, public, private, charter, whatever, and create those charter laws and voucher laws at the state level to allow it to do it, then these issues about the federal government become irrelevant. Then you can force federal
money.
See,
I'm with you. I'm kind of with you on choice. This is one of the few areas I don't follow my federal conservatives. I'm with you on choice. On the other hand, I do feel it is incumbent upon government to provide education, and I do worry that if you start pulling money out, you will crash school districts. See, I come at this from a different angle. What I think is Washington should divest itself of concern for education, and it should be the way it was when I went to school and when you went to school. Hopefully you're younger than me. It should just be state controlled. Give it to the states. Let the state of Pennsylvania educate its children, and Washington does not take part in that. If the state of Pennsylvania wants to do choice, do choice. It should not be part of the national debate at all. Let the state of Pennsylvania do that. That's what I think.
I agree with that. The difficulty, and these are these arcane issues that a lot of people at the, you know, who are just doing what they should be doing, running their family and their businesses and whatever, and going to work, and those of us have the luxury to play with these ideas. But the reality, Jack, is that the money that is coming from Washington to go to schools and school districts, mostly school districts, are actually oppositional to choice because they go to school districts. So now that we have this world where we do have a federal program that's filling in the gaps for disadvantaged or special needs kids, we at least want to be able to say, well, that money should follow kids to the schools of choice, not because the federal government says so, but because if that state already has a choice program, why wouldn't it be going where the kids are?
Well, but see, here's where we disagree a little bit. And I don't want to be a hard-hearted conservative.
Yeah, no,
I want to be a compassionate conservative. But here's where we disagree. If there are special needs kids and there are disadvantaged kids, once again, that's an issue for the state of Pennsylvania. If the state of Pennsylvania needs to raise more money, then it should tax more. It should do whatever it wants to do. If there are disadvantaged kids in Philadelphia, talk to Harrisburg. Don't talk to Washington.
Right.
Washington is getting involved. Washington shouldn't be involved with disadvantaged children in Philadelphia. See, that's the problem. That's the problem I have.
Okay, so then we have two issues, right? And that one is that could very well be the case. And Pennsylvania should have to make that up. And people in Pennsylvania should push their legislatures to spend money wisely so they're actually educating
kids
rather than leaving them in these awful schools that don't educate them. That's why we have school choice, because we have this broken system where we're funding the wrong things. We're funding buildings. We're not funding student success. Totally with you. However, in 2000, this is where I and the Center for Education Reform come down on it. We are in 2017. We have a federal government that has Department of Education, that has programs, and we have states that are still ascribing to this 18th century model of education, and we want it to change, and we think the best way to do it is not necessarily incrementally, but it's to change the power structure. You know, Milton Friedman used to talk about this issue constantly, right? He's the godfather of vouchers. God rest his soul. And he talked about making sure that those programs, that basically that money be delivered to students through vouchers, the federal government stay out. And didn't want to worry about whether the federal government was involved or not. It just takes too much energy. We don't have the unions on our side, right?
Yeah.
We don't have all
that
money
for sure.
And time. So starting with the reality that what do we do now? Now we have a Department of Education who's run by a woman who supports school choice and a president who actually committed to making it happen, not as a federal program, but as an incentive or driving
well,
the money back.
That's fine. But see, here's the devil in the details. I don't want Washington forcing choice on states either. I want Washington out. In other words, what I don't want is to substitute one big brother for the next, where we come in and say, okay, we're going to keep all this, but now we're going to force choice on the state of Pennsylvania. My thing is get Washington out of it. Washington shouldn't be encouraging choice.
Right.
It should have no role. Now, I don't know if you agree with that.
Well, I think it's a matter of not forcing it, but again, I'm looking at an incentive. I don't think it's forcing it to say, if you want to do school choice, state of Colorado, if you want to do school choice, Pennsylvania, we have money that would come to you.
That's one bureaucracy for the next. See, that's just one. That's better than this, but you're getting into one evil for the next, and then you grow out of bureaucracy to do that. I think what we're doing is we're emasculating state governments. State governments, see, this all fee education is the perfect segue into the we need to revive state governments. We're letting state governments abdicate all their responsibility. It's easy for people in Harrisburg, not to pick on Pennsylvania, but it's easy for in Harrisburg and Albany. They dump it all on Washington. They dump it all on Washington, and they say, you make the hard choices. We're getting out of all hard choices. Federalize everything, right? That's easy for those state capitals.
Right, absolutely. And if you want that money, the federal government should be saying you should do something about it. And so I think that in today's reality, my biggest concern, first and foremost, is that today in America, more than 60% of kids can't do anything proficiently. Read, write, spell, geography, history, civics, you name it. Right? So we want to solve that problem. I could spend time. I come from a political philosophy background. I'm a huge fan of the Federalist. You know, I won't want to spend my time doing that. I want to spend time figuring out how, in today's genre, we can work together across various different lines and say, how do we make sure that those kids are in schools of choice today? Pennsylvania legislators have had chances year after year, as have many others. And I'll tell you what, those state legislators sometimes are just, if not more, captured by influence, even on the Republican side, as the people in Washington.
Riddle me this. If you look back to 1974, we now spend inflation adjusted much more on education, I think something like 2.5 to 1 as a nation than we did then. And in relative terms, relative and absolute terms, we produced much better kids and much better educated kids then. Would that not be evidence for the thesis that the problems with today's kids are sociocultural? In other words, what's the independent variable and what's the dependent variable? Is not education policy the dependent variable downstream from very profound cultural collapse?
No, I think that's
no?
a very small part of it. Nope,
no?
Absolutely not. Because what we know today, given a world of school choice where we've had 26 years of charter schools, over 7,000 in 43 states serving over 3 million kids. We have lots of data. We have some 20 voucher or scholarship tax credit-based programs in states. And then we have evidence from when kids go to private schools and those parents make choices. A family is the major factor in whether or not the sociocultural issues a student does well or not. Second to the family, a teacher is the most important part of a child's life. A teacher can close the gap by as much as 2 years if they're effective and if they know their subject. And you know where we find those? We find those in schools of choice that are held accountable for results, open to parents by choice, and allowed and free to do what they need to do to
serve kids. Let me ask you this. Why was it better 50 years ago? In other words, there wasn't a lot of choice then. Why was it better then? What's happened in 50 years? If you say that that's okay, so you're arguing that education is the independent variable, education policy, I'll take you at your word. What was better then?
I do think there are two things. One is we have a whole heck of a lot more people actually going and staying in school, and rightly so. And two, we do have a larger, more expansive pool of challenges and issues with kids that aren't taken care of by the traditional family community structure that once tended to work for people. And so more people with more diversity, with more, more challenges and more needs, not an excuse, but it actually makes having school a more difficult thing. Now, the good news is we also know more about how kids learn than ever before. We have access to technology, and you should be able to get a physics professor in front of a kid in a heartbeat through technology if you don't have them in person. And so our challenges are bigger, but so are our opportunities.
Well, you're a good expert. You're adroitly, though, evading the real issue, and that is, can any society have good education as long as you have People magazine on the coffee table and the Kardashians on TV? That's the real question you're evading, right?
No, I'm not at all. I think actually that's a great question, and the way to get around that cultural, that we have too much cultural literacy and not enough educational literacy, right? We don't value education the way we used to. That's absolutely right, and part of the reason is we force students and we force families to go to the school down the street with no option whatsoever. We have larger labor union involvement and larger lobbyist vested interest than ever before.
All right.
And where you don't have any ability to change the landscape for kids, you're not empowered, you're not involved. Parents are not engaged because we leave them out.
Jeannie Allen, why weren't you the choice? You're a lot smarter than Betsy DeVos, although I think she's pretty good. All right, Jeannie Allen, CEO, Center for Education Reform. Maybe she'll be Donald Trump's next education secretary. Coming up next, we have another bright person, Horace Cooper, going to tell you all about the legal aspects of the travel ban. Stay tuned.
All the stories and controversies that no one talks about, but everyone should know about.
Why don't you get a toupee with some brains in it?
Behind the Curtain with Jack Berkman.
Welcome back. Well, in just a minute, we'll be joined by our friend Horace Cooper, great contributor to this show, the man I think is America's greatest constitutional mind and lawyer. And also, if our friend Jeff Sessions is not confirmed, and I hope he will, I think he will be, but if for any reason he's not, Horace is the man I want to advocate for the next AG, and I think Horace should be Donald Trump. You know, if Donald Trump gets two terms, he could end up picking as many as five Supreme Court justices. It's possible with the age of some of these cats on the Supreme Court. I want Horace to be one of those. Who knows, if Trump does two terms, he could go through four or five attorney generals. Who knows? You go through a number of them. So Horace has got to be one of those, and I will be advocating that. Well, the Ninth Circuit, the travel ban, to me, it looks like a very simple legal issue. We'll see what Horace says in a second. But people coming into this country, if they haven't yet entered America, no constitutional rights attach. So for the Ninth Circuit to say, and the trial judge before that to say, that there are constitutional questions involving the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment, I don't know how you could possibly argue that. I mean, that's leaving aside the whole issue of whether states can claim damages and have standing. Maybe that's a somewhat murkier issue. I don't think there are any damages, but admittedly, it's somewhat murkier. But this issue, I don't know how, unless they are now extending constitutional rights to not only aliens in the United States, which I think is bad enough, but that's settled law, and to now people who aren't even in the country, which is nuts, because that means that somebody in Moscow could claim that they have constitutional rights in the states. Horace Cooper, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, you're joining us with a cigar from your patio, but I wish you were joining us from as Attorney General from the Justice Department. Maybe someday I'll get my wish.
Well, let's focus in on today's issue,
yes.
And that is, this is a good example. If people watch the arguments, they were broadcast, or at least they were simulcast. If you watch those, it's a good argument for why we want the judicial branch to be out in the public. If you had sat in a class and answered questions or asked the kinds of questions that these three judges did, you would have been ridiculed. Now, normally, this kind of wacky decision-making is not seen by the American people because federal courts don't allow cameras or audio in the courtroom. An exception was made in this case, and we got to see how bad this was.
It's almost like the Florida Supreme Court 17 years ago, Horace, huh?
Absolutely. And in this case, the judges decided that they weren't even going to focus in on the issues that were briefed. Here's the crux of the questions that they were trying to drill down on. Does the First Amendment's provision that there shall not be an establishment of religion mean that if the President of the United States wins election after having campaigned on what was called a Muslim ban and then enacts an order that restricts immigrants, can they use their power to then strike it down? That is not what the ACLU argued. That is not what People for the American Way or any of the Muslim front groups that Soros has been funded argue. That's not even what the briefs suggested. This took us way, way far beyond where things are. The primary problem, and there are lots, the primary problem is what you're supposed to do with a statute is look at what the statute says. I can say that I'm regulating automobiles all day long in public releases. If my regulation has nothing to do with automobiles, I'm not bound by the specifics of what rhetoric was used outside of the classroom or any public arena. And yet, these guys specifically kept asking the question about the president's, as a candidate's, campaign promises. They ignored the reality that this was an interagency task force recommendation, that largely the seven countries that had been designated came as a result of Barack Obama's efforts and the prior administration. And they also ignored the fact that when the Congress of the United States attempted to pass a bill that President Obama threatened to veto, it also included these very jurisdictions. It is remarkable to me that instead of focusing on the bill at hand or the actual executive order, they decided they wanted to know, well, what was going on in his mind when he enacted it. That's failure, Constitution 101.
I presume, given all the absurdity, I presume that the final ruling of the Ninth Circuit will be against the administration. Is that accurate?
Yes, you're right. And the reason that's right is, if we had seen any kind of mainstream questioning, I would have said, nope, we're going to see that the Judge Robart's order is going to be overturned. But we didn't see any mainstream type arguments. This would set a dramatic precedent, one that ultimately has to be overturned by the Supreme Court if they were to argue that this was a First Amendment violation that impinges on the ability of the president to make a national security determination.
Now, let me ask you this. Why would the First Amendment even apply if people aren't even in the country, though?
It doesn't. But this is the point.
That's the issue.
What they're saying is we don't actually care about who these people are. We're saying that the president's action itself is something that has been brought to our attention. The only problem with that is it hasn't been brought to their attention. No one has said, the way we did with the Affordable Care Act, does the government actually have the power to compel you to do X? The case is not, does a president have a power to issue an executive order?
So you have no aggrieved plaintiff. In other words, this is now in the abstract. There's no aggrieved plaintiff.
Absolutely in the abstract.
This is an abstract violation of the First Amendment. There is no plaintiff. They're issuing an advice. It's an advisory ruling. It's a theoretical advisory ruling, basically.
The Constitution precludes that. It says that we're not supposed to. You actually have to have a case, an actual dispute. Now, I've been to Washington State. Many other people are lovely. They haven't identified a particular injury or harm. The executive order doesn't require the state of Washington to expend a single dollar. It doesn't require the individuals who work for the state to be forced into some action. The court has been clear that the federal government may not do those things. This simply says, hey, we're not going to let's pretend.
Let me ask you, other question in the time remaining. Could Trump take the argument, refresh me on con law, Horace, can the Ninth Circuit, the Ninth Circuit makes a ruling, does that necessarily extend beyond its jurisdiction? Is it precedent or custom that you would follow it beyond its jurisdiction?
So it's custom that it would follow, but the initial stay was written to be a nationwide stay. So the stay would have the effect of barring everywhere. The Ninth Circuit would only be able to create a precedent in this place. But Japanese steel, during the Reagan administration, there was a temporary ban as we negotiated. The Ninth Circuit was essentially saying that it would be okay for Washington State to say,
Horace Cooper, we got to go. I am so sorry. Horace Cooper, thank you so much. If we are very, very lucky, we'll have you back again. My next candidate for AG or the Supreme Court. Well, remember, even when we're not on the air, you can hear us and see us and read all about us at jackberkmanradio.com. And, of course, always at radioamerica.com. You've got to see our website, new and improved. Remember, if you want to take it behind the curtain, call us 703-795-5364. And we'll see you next week.